seizure of our political system by global corporations is depressing. And I think that we have to confront what's before us, including our failed democracy, and yet rise up and resist anyway, that it's a kind of moral imperative, because we are responsible for the world that comes after us. And even if we fail, and we may fail, but even if we fail, at least let those who come after us say they tried. And if we are passive in front of this system, we are complicit in what Immanuel Kant would call radical evil.
That's Chris Hedges, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Chris Hedges on Rise Up and Resist. When is enough enough? In the face of evil, what does it take for people to move from passivity to active resistance? Throughout history, there have been instances of people defying tyranny, fighting back, no matter what the odds. An example comes from Nazi Germany, often considered the benchmark of evil. Opposition to the regime was highly dangerous. 75 years ago, Hans and Sophie Scholl, brother and sister, and others at the University of Munich said, "Genug, enough." They formed the White Rose Movement and called on Germans to recognize their moral duty and overthrow the government. They disseminated critical information through flyers and graffiti. One such graffiti said, "Whatever comes out of Hitler's mouth is a lie." In 1943, Hans and Sophie Scholl were arrested and beheaded. Their resistance and courage are honored today. They took risks. Can we? Our guest today is Chris Hedges. He's an award-winning journalist who has reported from the Balkans, the Middle East, and Central America. He writes a weekly column for TruthDig.com. He's the author of many books, including America, The Farewell Tour. I talked with him in the studios of KGNU in Boulder, Colorado. Welcome to the program, Chris Hedges.
Thank you, David.
Well, why a farewell tour?
Because this is the end of American empire. And all of the warning signs that exist when empires disintegrate are flashing red. The expansion of a military machine that is hollowing the country out from the inside, the erosion of civil liberties, the deindustrialization of our cities, the capture of our political process by a tiny cabal, in this case corporate, that redirects all of the institutions that once made reform possible towards the further consolidation of power and amassing of obscene amounts of wealth. The political system no longer functions, at least in terms of propelling a society forward. It's rolling that society backwards as we enrich this tiny global financial elite, and which is largely orchestrated a tax boycott. They pay little to no taxes. Remember, under Eisenhower, the wealthiest individuals and corporations paid 91% tax. Now they have to extract that money from a beleaguered population. That's why you get programs not only of austerity, but debt peonage, student debt, $1.5 trillion. Household debts over $13 trillion. You're late on your credit card, that's 28% interest. You go into poor communities, and they're just fined to death for the most ridiculous offenses, including obstruction on pedestrian walkways, which means standing on a sidewalk, not mowing your lawn, which is actually a fine in Ferguson, Missouri, because with the loss of tax revenue, these counties and states can't fill their budgets. And because that oligarchic elite has rendered themselves untouchable, and we can watch massive acts of fraud by Goldman Sachs or banks, and nobody's held accountable, then the system, for its pound of flesh, takes it out of the most vulnerable.
Is Trump a symptom of something much deeper?
Yeah, Trump is a symptom of a political system that is seized up and doesn't work. And that's why we're seeing Trump-like figures appear throughout the industrialized world, Viktor Orban in Hungary, Nigel Farage or Boris Johnson in Britain, you know, the Polish government just destroyed their legal system, the Swedish elections just brought to power these right-wing nationalists, because in essence, this global financial elite has seized control of national economies. We see it in Greece, and the citizens have lost the ability to determine both economic and political policy. And so the debate has shifted, and Thatcher and Reagan were largely responsible for this. It shifted towards an assault on national identity. You know, the idea that 11 million undocumented workers are somehow responsible for the economic decline of the United States is patently absurd. But it works when you have corporations controlling your media platforms and there's no rational discussion of corporate capitalism or how it works. And as we move closer towards a financial crisis, and one is coming, another one, you will see that kind of language and incitement to violence, which Trump has already done, be ratcheted up.
What are the signs of a coming economic crash? You mentioned debt.
Well, so what happened after 2008 is that the banks and the global speculators received at virtually 0% interest $26 trillion, according to the University of Missouri, of fabricated money out of electronic ether. What they did with this money was not invest it in the society. They didn't build new factories, create new jobs the way a traditional capitalist structure would. What they did was hoard it, buy back their own stock. That's what they did with most of the money from the tax cuts, because their compensation packages are tied. That's why the overheated stock market, the idea that that is somehow a symbol of a healthy economy, is absurd. Or they invested it in very risky ventures like fracking. So the value of the fracking industry is determined not by their profits. In fact, it's a money-losing operation in almost all places. And they've had to borrow tremendous amounts of money, over $280 billion, to keep it going. But the fracking industry is valued, like the dot-com industry, on projected profits. But at a certain moment, that bubble bursts. Estimates are that within a couple decades, 40% of the people who have student loans will have defaulted. The system's not sustainable. Now, what happens this time around is that the elites don't have a plan B. They can't lower interest rates any more than they've already lowered them, which is virtually zero. I mean, in fact, some central banks in Europe were lending out money at negative interest rates. They would pay you to borrow money. And that flirts with what will be the death blow of the American empire, and that is the day the dollar is no longer the world's reserve currency.
And why is that significant?
Well, because then the dollar's value collapses completely. I mean, it's a fictitious value as it is, but it's held up because it is the world's reserve currency. It remains the world's reserve currency. We saw an example of that when, in the 1950s, the pound sterling was dropped as the world's reserve currency. One of the characteristics of late empire is that it makes disastrous military decisions, military fiascos. So in the Athenian Empire, in ancient Greece, they attempted to invade Sicily. Their entire fleet was sunk, and most of their soldiers were killed. The empire disintegrated. In 56, Great Britain attempted to invade Egypt after Nasser nationalized the Suez Canal and had to retreat in humiliation. And that led to the pound sterling being dropped as the world's reserve, and that they were finished. And our greatest strategic blunder in American history has been the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan, 17 years of warfare. They're not winnable conflicts. In fact, the Taliban controls more territory in Afghanistan than when we went in. There's no way to extract. We have just created one failed state after another, whether that's Libya, Syria. Iraq is a unified country, doesn't exist anymore. And again, this is driven not by a rational foreign policy. because each year we're there, it gets worse and worse and worse, including, of course, sending millions of refugees into Europe, which exacerbated the nativist movements within Europe. You know, the breakdown of these societies saw the rise of an array of radical jihadist groups. The only reason you continue these wars is because it's highly profitable to corporations like Northrop Grumman and Halliburton and Raytheon. And that really is, as far as I can see, the only reason we're still there, and is the only reason we have expanded NATO. So I was in Warsaw not long ago, and I get off at the airport. There's a giant billboard advertising Raytheon, because that's a huge business. If you've got to reconfigure a Soviet bloc military to be compatible with NATO weaponry. And in order to do that, you've got to demonize Russia as a threat, to sell these countries, which don't have the money anyway, on billions in American arms. So much of our policy is driven by the obsession on the part of large corporations to achieve profit, even if it accelerates the disintegration of the nation itself. And this really gets to what Karl Marx described as the late stage of capitalism, where corporations impoverish the citizenry to such an extent that in order to maintain high levels of profit, they cannibalize the very institutions that make a capitalist democracy possible. So we see that with the push, and Arne Duncan under Obama was guilty of this, but we see this push by Betsy DeVos,
the education secretary.
Right, for charter schools. And why? It's because we spend about $63 billion a year on education and the hedge funds want it. I opened the book in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and Scranton's facing insolvency. This was, I think, at one point the fourth largest manufacturing center, or even per capita income, I guess it is, was in the country, I mean, decades ago. So their pension fund has been wiped out by the speculators on Wall Street by 40%. And they're selling off their city assets, the sewer system, the parking authority, the utilities. And, of course, what happens is these corporations come in and jack up the rates. And the per capita income is about $45,000 a year. But what happens when they don't have any assets to sell off? And this is writ large throughout the country. And so as the country disintegrates, you're watching the mechanisms by which we maintain control on the edges or outer reaches of empire become familiar within empire itself. That's mass incarceration, mostly of poor people of color who have been trapped in deindustrialized pockets of the country without meaningful employment. Mass incarceration is first and foremost a form of social control, but it's also a way for corporations to extract profit. A black or brown body on the street of a depressed part of an American city can't generate money for a corporation, but that body can generate $50,000 or $60,000 a year once they lock it in a cage. And that's why we've seen corporations move so aggressively into the prison system, so that all services in prison systems are now privatized. The money transfer service, which is JPay, the Global Tel Link, which does the phone service and jacks up the rates so that it's 4 to 5 times higher what you and I pay. The commissary is privatized, medical is privatized, and of course the object, as we saw with the battle to get Mumia Abu-Jamal treated for Hep C, is not to provide expensive care because they're there to make money. The Aramart, the food is privatized. So it's now a multi-billion dollar industry extracting money from the most vulnerable and the poorest among us. In many ways, you know, Dostoevsky said, if you want to understand a society, look at how they run their prisons. And prisons have become, for me, the kind of template for where these corporations would like to drive all of us. Because you now have, I mean, about 1 million people in the prison system who work for for-profit corporations. McDonald's makes its uniforms in prisons. Well, they don't pay them. I mean, in Georgia, they don't pay them anything. But you pay them, you know, 25 cents an hour, or if they're fighting fires in California, it's $1 an hour. They can't organize. They can't complain about their working conditions. They never show up late. If They're sick. They don't get paid. They don't get paid for vacation days. Nobody has to pay into Social Security. And you can have people in prison work for 20, 30 years, 40 hours a week, and they have no Social Security. And if they create problems, you put them in solitary confinement. So what has taken place at the lowest levels of our society should be a warning to the rest of us, because these corporations operate on a very perverted logic, and one Marx understood, and that is consolidating and amassing greater profit and reducing the cost of labor, and that's it.
In your book, you favorably quote the Italian Marxist philosopher Antonio Gramsci, who died in 1937. He was in Mussolini's jails for many years, anti-fascist. He talked about morbid symptoms appearing during an interregnum while a kind of society is finding its footing. And you suggest that we're in that kind of moment now.
Yeah, and that's why I quote Gramsci, because so when you're trapped in what Durkheim calls this anomy, this alienation, this stagnation, you begin to express it. I mean, as Durkheim said, a society can't be sick without you being affected. And we see it with the opioid crisis, gambling. I wrote my gambling chapter out of the Trump Taj Mahal before Trump ever announced. I didn't know Trump was going to run for president.
The Atlantic City
Atlantic
Casino?
Atlantic City, right. And so by then it had been through multiple bankruptcies. It was a decayed wreck. There were mold spots in the ceiling. Lights were burned out. Most of the rooms were mothballed. They just couldn't even maintain them anymore. The urinals were covered with plastic bags with the words "out of order" on them. And there were rodents. Literally, most of the restaurants were closed down, but the few that remained open, you could watch rats or mice scurry across the floor, a kind of a symbol for where he's going to lead us. And the whole idea that casinos are somehow a form of economic development, they've now proliferated across the country, partly, again, to fill the shortages in state and county revenues, because the elites no longer pay taxes, or they hardly pay any taxes. And so for me, that whole gaming industry or the casino industry is one that is kind of a metaphor for the casino capitalism that we live under, and the yearning on the part of people in despair to become a Donald Trump. I mean, when Trump was campaigning, he used to say to the crowds, "It's not about me, it's about you." And inadvertently, that may be the one honest thing he ever said, because we live in a society which Neil Postman kind of foresaw coming, where we all want to amass wealth and celebrity and power and fame, and it doesn't matter how we get there. You see that celebrated throughout the culture, that wealth and power are its own virtue. And if you go to that casino, if you're coming from Chinatown or Philadelphia or something, you're bussed in at the bottom. If you're a high roller, you land on the helipad at the top of the Trump Casino and stay in these $10,000 a night suites that are named for famous historical figures like Cleopatra or Alexander the Great. But the idea is to rise within that structure, to become these figures. And we have on social media these mini platforms that are really like Facebook and Twitter and Instagram that are just about self-presentation. It's what Neil Gabler called life the movie. So we're all infected with it.
You mentioned Neil Postman. He wrote a book in 1985 called Amusing Ourselves to Death, Public Discourse in the Age of Show Business. He writes, "When a population becomes distracted by trivia, when cultural life is redefined as a perpetual round of entertainments, when serious public conversation becomes a form of baby talk, when, in short, a people become an audience and their public business a vaudeville act, then a nation finds itself at risk. Culture death is a clear possibility." And you quote a Postman in your book as well.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, because he was prophetic about where we were headed and the danger of essentially allowing celebrity entertainment to infect journalism. I mean, what are politicians? You know, like Bill Clinton or Barack Obama, they're manufactured personalities. There's no substance. It's, and remember the old clash or campaign between Al Gore and Bush, who do you want to have a beer with? I mean, this is insane. But they're very skillful, the public relations industry, which is arguably one of the most evil industries in America, at making us confuse how we are made to feel with knowledge. And that manipulation now, courtesy of handheld devices, just goes on 24 hours a day. And we are, I think, as Borstein wrote, probably the most illusioned society in human history. Meanwhile, we are being impoverished, stripped of our civil liberties, have amassed an oligarchic elite that, you know, rivals that that existed. I mean, I think is great in terms of income inequality is worse than what took place under the Gilded Age. And you can't maintain a democracy in an oligarchy. That isn't a particularly sophisticated political thought. Aristotle elaborated on that some 3,000 years ago.
Well, didn't Louis Brandeis, the Supreme Court justice, say you can have two things. You can have democracy or you can have great concentrations of wealth, but you can't have both.
Right. And Aristotle said that, you know, when you have that income inequality, then your only two choices are tyranny or revolution.
Let's go back to Gramsci again, because you write in your book that he would have despaired of the divide in the United States between our anemic left and the working class.
Well, so, I mean, we had radical union movements, the Wobblies, the old CIO, the old United Mine Workers. And that, in the name of anti-communism or the Red Scare, they were eviscerated, especially in the 1950s after World War II. And Ellen Schrecker has written some good books on this, which were, there was stuff she wrote, she's a historian, on that period that I didn't know. I mean, that it didn't, it wasn't just the Hollywood writers and Pete Seeger and Dalton Trumbo and but the FBI was going into high schools with lists of quote-unquote reds with no evidence. And then these teachers were fired and blacklisted. They couldn't work again. It really, all through the layers of society, they were purging people with a social conscience, critics of capitalism. The effects of that were quite devastating. We saw a rise of movements in the 1960s, and then this contemporary ferocious assault, which began in the early 70s, and Lewis Powell's memo, Attack on the Free Enterprise System, is kind of the blueprint for that.
1971.
And so from that point onward, labor unions were decimated, and we just saw with these so-called right-to-work laws a further attack on unions. Only 6% now of the American workforce in the private sector is unionized at all. But with the right-to-work law, employers can't even make contracts with unions. It really expands the ability of employers to hire exclusively non-union labor. And so this reconfiguration of American society is one where we have been left virtually defenseless as these forces roll forward. And you know, as Carl Polanyi writes in The Great Transformation, unfettered, unregulated capitalism is ultimately a destructive and a self-destructive force because it commodifies everything. We haven't even spoken about climate change. It commodifies human beings and it commodifies the natural world in the name of short-term profit until exhaustion or collapse. And there's no constraints anymore. And part of the, I think, what all of us who read climate change reports fear is that these elites are utterly incapable of responding rationally to the greatest existential threat to face the human species. And it isn't just Trump. I mean, yeah, Trump is a climate denier, but the whole mantra that we can somehow adapt, or the Paris Climate Accords, which are non-binding limits on carbon emissions. I mean, all of this fails to confront the gravity of what's before us.
The question always comes up, though, these corporate managers, they know the science, they're getting reports, they're getting, you know, accurate information, and they have children and grandchildren. So how can they be acting in ways that are endangering their own families?
Well, because in order to become the CEO of BP, you probably have to have a psychopathic personality. These are not – I went to school with them. Unfortunately, I was shipped off to an exclusive boarding school at the age of 10 in New England, Eagle Brook and then Loomis, on scholarship. So I grew up with these people. I went to school with Lewis Scooter Libby. I know who they are. I know who Kavanaugh is. I know them all. And they are incredibly entitled, incredibly narcissistic. They believe that their wealth will protect them. And they are engaging in behavior that in the short term makes them wealthier and more powerful. And I don't think they see beyond it. You know, by the time you reach that level, you are so winnowed out. I mean, I worked at the New York Times for 15 years, and there's a kind of vetting process where those who rise within the New York Times or any corporation do so because they exhibit a loyalty to the institution, not to the individuals who work for it or the individuals that are exploited by it. And that is a very distorted personality. But institutions are quite good at selecting those who will kneel before its altar. And I come out of seminary. I mean, it is a form of idolatry. And we were taught in seminary that the danger of idols is not just that it demands human sacrifice, but in the end, it demands self-sacrifice, that you're finally slaughtered on the altar. And that's precisely what's happening. They think they're going to escape it. I mean, you've got these Silicon Valley millionaires buying empty missile silos in the Midwest where they think they're going to – I can tell them from covering the former Yugoslavia that the people who rule when society breaks down are those who have the guns, and their bodyguards are not going to sit around and take orders from them once society disintegrates.
You're listening to Chris Hedges on Rise Up and Resist. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program and the Hedges book, America, the Farewell Tour, by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. I want to draw a little bit on your studies of the Christian evangelical right in the United States. You wrote a book called American Fascism, The Christian Right and the War on America. Large numbers of evangelical Christians in this country are ardent nationalists and fervent believers in capitalism. 81% of them voted in the 2016 presidential election for Donald Trump, a thrice-married casino mogul who has a penchant for mendacity and cavorts with porn stars and Playboy bunnies. How can they do that?
Because they're cut from the same cloth, with maybe this distinction. The white men who run most of these megachurches have sexual proclivities that are probably kinkier than Trump. I find this whole question of how can the Christian right support Trump to be an utter misreading of the Christian right. I spent 2 years with them. This is a movement that, and I speak as a seminary graduate, is heretical. They're Christian heretics. They have acculturated the worst aspects of American imperialism and capitalism into the Christian religion. They sacralized it. And you don't have to spend 3 years at Harvard Divinity School, as I did, to figure out that Jesus didn't come to make us rich. But that marriage of the iconography and language of religion, of the Christian religion, all you see it with Modi in India, of any religion, with the state, is a recipe for fascism. And when I was at Harvard Divinity School, my great mentor, James Luther Adams, had been at the University of Heidelberg in 1936 and 37. He'd actually been in the lecture hall watching Heidegger begin his lectures with a Nazi salute. And he dropped out and joined the so-called Confessing Church, led by Niemöller, Bonhoeffer, Karl Barth, Albert Schweitzer, and took home movies of both the Confessing Church, but more importantly, the so-called German Christian Church, which was for me like the Christian Right, in that on one side of the altar you had the Christian cross, and on the other you had the Nazi swastika. And Adams told us that when we were his age, he was then 80 years old, we would all be fighting the Christian fascists, because he saw what happened when you dispossessed a working class and you had a movement that fused the symbols of a religion with the symbols of the state. And I remember at the time, and he was certainly one of the most brilliant scholars I ever studied with, thinking even he was being a bit hyperbolic. But not anymore. He was right. And so Trump has no ideology. But we are watching that ideological void being filled with the fascism of the Christian right.
And no theology as well?
There's no theology because they're selective literalists. They pick passages from the Bible that support their ideology. I mean, one of the fascinating things that I found spending 2 years going from megachurch to megachurch and pro-life weekends and creationist seminars. I took evangelism explosion course with D. James Kennedy. I was always upfront about who I was. I never tried to go undercover, and I told them that I graduated from seminary, and my father was a minister, so I grew up in the church. And as soon as they knew it, they never wanted to talk about the Bible with me because they're biblical illiterates. They focus on certain passages in Revelation or Paul and ignore the Beatitudes, for instance. Because it is about giving their ideology the veneer of religiosity. It's not authentic religiosity. Now, one of the things that did occur in the course of writing that book is that I was deeply moved by the suffering of many of those people who were propelled into the arms of this movement. And that suffering was very real. Sexual, domestic abuse, struggles with addictions, unemployment, underemployment, jail time, all of the things that are gripping, the kind of malaise that is gripping the underclass. And it was understandable why these people fell into this cultish movement and embraced magical thinking. Magic Jesus was going to save them because the real world, the world of fact, the secular world out there almost destroyed them. And I was in Detroit for an End Times weekend with Tim LaHaye, who wrote the End Times series. And it was fascinating to watch in this church how exhilarated these people were about the end, you know, the apocalypse. And the graphic descriptions were not in the Bible, you know, the blood of non-believers boiling and their eyes popping out. It was this kind of stuff. And it made me see their yearning for apocalyptic violence very differently. And I think that that yearning came from the fear of being pushed back into a world that almost destroyed them. It's why you can never argue them out of their belief of creationism, because that's the last platform that holds them together. And at the end of the book, I said the only way to break this movement is to reintegrate these people into the society, to give them jobs with economic stability and a living wage, to recreate the communal structures, especially the safety net that once protected the vulnerable. Otherwise, we're finished. And of course, I wrote that book 10 years ago, and it's only gotten worse.
Why are some Christian evangelicals so tightly connected to Israel? What does Israel represent to them?
Well, in the ideology of the Christian right, that's where Armageddon will take place. And it's interesting because they have all sorts of weird ideas, but one of them is that 160,000 or something Jews will convert, but the rest of the Jews will perish. And so it plays into their mythology. And also, as American Jews in later generations, younger Jews, lose their emotional bonds with Israel, Israel quite assiduously courts the Christian right and sees them as their natural ally, as especially young American Jews are not slavishly devoted to Israeli policies. I mean, I speak at universities all over the country and often meet with Students for Justice in Palestine, and usually half of them are Jewish.
You've talked, as well as CLR James has written about, and Edward Said, you've talked about Captain Ahab and Moby Dick, the great American novel by Melville. What lessons or what is in that novel that so attracts you in terms of explaining American imperialism?
Well, to quote CLR James, who wrote a whole book on Moby Dick, it's the story of the death of a civilization, and he's right. So if you look on the ship, the worst jobs are done by people of color. You have a certain moment in the novel when it's clear that Ahab is launched on a mission of collective suicide. Starbucks certainly knows, but they won't do anything. You know, those with a conscience fail to act. And it grasps the morally neutral universe that we live in, and in particular the natural world. Human civilization is only 10,000 years old, which is the end of the last ice age. It's a product of very peculiar aspects of the biosphere, including the Gulf Stream, which in the 4.5 billion years the planet has been around have not been part of the ecosystem. And we are rapidly destroying that small window. They call it the Holocene, for the Anthropocene, that made human life possible. And the Earth will go on around us. And Melville's very, of course, Melville had been on ships. I mean, Melville understood, like Homer in the Iliad, that the gods are neutral and they may be with you one day, but the next they're not. So I think there's just a lot in the novel that I think it is the greatest novel, American novel. And I think there's a lot in the novel that grasps the self-destructive quality, the mendacity of capitalism, because remember, the ships are owned by Quakers and, you know, they're just cheating people right and left. The whole lay system, you know, I don't know if you know, but you get a certain lay, which is a percentage of the profit. But you could get sailors on a 2-year voyage and they could get off and owe the owners money. I mean, so there's almost everything in that novel. It's including that the first kind of literary use of stream of consciousness that Faulkner and Proust would pick up on later.
And it was rich in biblical references. You must have enjoyed that.
Yeah, completely. Yeah.
But hard for a lot of people to access.
Well, that's, you know, we need losing touch with the print-based culture is death, because you forget where you came from. You forget how you got here, and you are unaware of the wisdom of the past. And that means you're very easily manipulated by very malicious powers.
We were talking about Christian evangelicals and magical thinking. The question always comes up is, how do you reach people? What vocabulary do you deploy to try to persuade people that 2 and 2 is indeed 4 and not 5? But who are convinced that it's 5.
You can't.
So you give up, you walk away?
No, you don't give up. I mean, so, you know, it was interesting. I mean, even when after my book on the Christian right came out, there were people I wrote about. I mean, the book was called American Fascists. But I wrote about the average person in the movement with great empathy because their suffering was real and because I felt compassion for what they went through. No, I think it's economic. I think that if the social bonds are not recreated and they're not reintegrated into the economic and political system, then we can't reach them, because to shatter their peculiar worldview is to leave them utterly bereft of any foundation by which they continue to exist. And so I think we have to organize around, for instance, you know, raising the minimum wage to $15 or $20. We have to organize around universal health care. We have to organize around issues that dramatically improve their lives. And that means building alliances with people in our communities whose peculiar worldviews may be different and even repugnant to ours. But no, I spent a lot of time with these people. And you're just not going to argue. I mean, the whole – I took a creationist seminar. And so this was a class for teachers in Christian schools, how to teach creationism. And the instructor had to confront the fact that the world is created on the first day, but light's not created till the fourth day. So what do you tell the students? Well, you tell the students that God created a temporary light. I mean, it's all in the details. It's ridiculous. It's not in the Bible. It's completely fabricated. But it shows you how disconnected their ideology is from reality. And that's just, you know, on every single level.
On a whole range of public issues, from protecting the environment to universal health care to having tuition-free colleges and universities, these are all, according to polls, including one commissioned by the Koch brothers, majoritarian
right.
views. Yet, the political class does not move forward on them. Why not?
Because we don't count. Because
we the people.
No. Legislation, we know statistically. I mean, legislation and laws are written by corporate lobbyists, and we've been utterly disempowered. We live in what Sheldon Wolin called a system of inverted totalitarianism, and by that he means it's not classical, not yet. Not classical totalitarianism.
It's not Gestapo and death camps.
Well, and it's not a Hitler or Mussolini. I mean, I don't think Trump has reached that point. So you have the facade. It's like the late Roman Republic. You have the facade of the Republic. But internally, corporations have seized all of the levers of power to render the citizen impotent. Really, it doesn't matter. I mean, it doesn't matter. Kavanaugh commits perjury. I mean, there's no question he goes right on to the Supreme Court. I mean, it's remarkable. The laws don't matter, at least for the rich. And then you have a criminalization of poverty. So, you know, mowing your lawn or not mowing your lawn or standing on a sidewalk, which means obstructing pedestrian traffic or having an open container, you're fined and jailed. Why? Because these county and state governments, because nobody pays taxes, and under Eisenhower, the wealthiest corporations and individuals paid 91% tax. They don't have any revenues, so they can't get it from corporations because they're immune. So you take it from the vulnerable. So the pressure on the poor and the working poor is just getting worse and worse and worse and worse. We're powerless to do anything about it because the system, whether it's the Democrats or the Republicans, the established elites are beholden to corporate money.
Gramsci used to say, and is often quoted by Edward Said and Iqbal Ahmed and others, as saying that he had pessimism of the intellect and optimism of the will. Is this something that appeals to you?
Yes, because, I mean, people say, well, you know, it's so bleak, it's so depressing. Well, it's bleak and depressing. And I think the greatest existential crisis of our time is to grasp what's before us from climate change alone. I mean, if we stop all carbon emissions today, which we're not doing, we would still suffer catastrophic climate change. And one of the reasons that climate scientists are so terrified of going beyond 2 degrees Celsius in terms of global warming is that they know from studying other planets like Venus, which once had water and now is 800 degrees, that it triggers feedback loops, which you can't control. There's nothing you can do then. And they've run mathematical scenarios on those loops that range from a 70% die-off of the human species to complete extinction. Well, that's bleak, and it's depressing. The seizure of our political system by corporate power, global corporations, is depressing. You know, the fact that 16 million hungry children go to bed in America every night is depressing. The fact that we have 2.3 million prisoners, 25% of the world's prison population, over half of whom were never charged with physically harming anyone, is depressing. And I think that we have to confront what's before us, including our failed democracy, and yet rise up and resist anyway, that it's a kind of moral imperative, because we are responsible for the world that comes after us. And even if we fail, and we may fail, but even if we fail, at least let those who come after us say they tried. And if we are passive in front of this system, we are complicit in what Immanuel Kant would call radical evil.
In 1988, the NASA scientist James Hansen went to Capitol Hill and for the first time talked about what was happening with the climate. He saw an increasingly warming of the Earth's temperature and the potential dangers that may pose down the line. Well, here we are 30 years later with the U.S. pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord, even with all its problems, and we are rapidly hurtling toward the abyss.
Well, climate change was first identified as a problem in 1905.
You mean 1965, right?
No, 1905.
05?
Yes. It was a scientist in Europe, I forget, from Sweden or somewhere, who identified it. But then you had Exxon, their scientists, in the 70s, understood the nature of global warming and its danger. So we've known for a long time. The elites have certainly known. But unfortunately, they chose their own personal profit and the profit of their corporations over human life. And that's why I don't hold out any hope for the elites. I mean, we have to remove this system from power. We have to overthrow the corporate state. And that comes through mass acts of sustained nonviolent civil disobedience, such as we saw in Standing Rock, such as I saw in East Germany, Czechoslovakia, and Romania, or we're finished, and we don't have much time left.
Are you familiar with the recent example of Armenia, for example?
Yeah.
That's quite a story. Here you had this really decrepit, oligarchic, entrenched regime that was literally overthrown by hundreds of thousands of people in the streets, shutting down the country.
Well, that's what happened in East Germany. I mean, I was in Alexanderplatz with 500,000 East Germans. And the Stasi state was the most efficient security and surveillance state in human history until our own.
This is the 25th anniversary of the Oslo Accords, which Edward Said denounced as a Palestinian Versailles. Since then, the possibilities of an independent, viable Palestinian state have receded under both Republican and Democratic administrations. What do you see in terms of the future for the Palestinians and for the region as a whole?
Well, I mean, that's why I support the boycott, divestment, and sanction movement, because it's the only weapon we have left. Israel's worried about it. That movement has gained a fair bit of traction in Europe. They are seeking the Israeli lobby to criminalize it here in the United States. I mean, we talk about Russian interference in the elections. How about Israeli interference in the elections? I mean, they literally, AIPAC gives money to candidates. And obviously, the assault is worse and worse, especially cutting off funding, U.S. funding to UNRWA.
The UN Relief Agency for Refugees.
That provides food. I mean, most people in Gaza depend at this point. They live in the largest open-air prison in the world. Don't have access. I mean, Israel has bombed the sewage treatment plants, so the whole coast of Gaza is filled with raw sewage. They bomb the power plants. 98% of the water is you can't drink. No, it's just a horror show. And the extremism of the Netanyahu government, which is openly racist, is a few steps away from calling for the extinction, if not the forced deportation, of the Palestinians. I mean, they already live in ringed ghettos, even in the West Bank, if you look at the military roads and the settlements and everything else. So, yeah, the failure on the part of the international community to respond to this horrific violation of international law and humanitarian crisis is really a terrible, terrible stain. But, of course, the Palestinians are poor and powerless, and everyone's quite willing to sell them out.
But Washington is the great enabler, not just with financial support.
That's why the BDS movement is so important in the United States.
Talk about, again, attitudes, of superior attitudes that I see on the left, let's say, or in liberal circles. Oh, I can't, I can't support Chris Hedges. You know, he voted for Nader. I can't support this person because she eats meat. I can't, you know, support this. I can't get involved with this person because they drive an SUV. Pretty soon, there's nobody left. You know, we've purged ourselves of potential allies.
Well, that's kind of the problem with identity politics, which isn't really it's not really politics. It's anti-politics. I mean, I'm all for diversity and multiculturalism, but divorced from economic and political justice, it's just boutique activism. And I think the left is kind of consumed, especially at the higher levels within the universities, in useless boutique activism.
Well, finding common ground, like universal health care, that doesn't seem to be a controversial issue. There's an enormous amount of support for it.
Right.
So can't we move forward on that, even though you eat meat, Chris Hedges?
Right.
And I can't talk to you on
the
vegetarian.
Well, you know, that's the great, I think it was Lord Salisbury, you know, there's no permanent allies, only permanent power. Saul Alinsky used to repeat that line all the time. And that's right. You know, we are going to have to build alliances with people who are different from us around issues like that if we're going to have any success at all.
Just yesterday, I got a letter from an old-fashioned letter with a stamp in it, from a woman in the Jemez Pueblo in New Mexico. And she had just heard an interview I did with Ralph Nader, in which he says, exhorts people to get involved and become citizen activists. And she writes, please tell me one thing I can do.
Well, there's no shortage of things to do wherever we live. There's injustice around us. Wherever we live, there's ICE breaking up families, separating parents from children. Wherever we live, there are corporations poisoning our soil, our air, and our water. Wherever we live, there are politicians selling out poor people of color. Wherever we live, there are prisons and jails where people are being held, poor people are being held in inhumane conditions. And I often look at that question, tell us what to do, as a way of not shutting down your screens and walking out your door and recognizing that there are many, many things to do, many injustices probably within a few blocks of your house that you must confront.
I'm wondering if I could get you to read the last section.
Sure.
Of America, the Farewell Tour.
Resistance is not fundamentally political. It is cultural and spiritual. It is about finding meaning and expression in the transcendent and the incongruities of life. Music, poetry, theater, and art sustain resistance by giving expression to the nobility of rebellion against the overwhelming forces which the ancient Greeks called fortuna, which can never ultimately be overcome. Art celebrates the freedom and dignity of those who defy malignant evil. Victory is not inevitable, or at least not victory as defined by the powerful. Yet in every act of rebellion, we are free. It was the raw honesty of the blues, spirituals, and work chants that made it possible for African Americans to endure. Power is a poison. It does not matter who wields it. The rebel, for this reason, is an eternal heretic. He or she will never fit into any system. The rebel stands with the powerless. There will always be powerless people. There will always be injustice. The rebel will always be an outsider. Resistance requires eternal vigilance. The moment the powerful are no longer frightened, the moment the glare of the people is diverted and movements let down their guard, the moment the ruling elites are able to use propaganda and censorship to hide their aims, the gains made by resistors roll backward. We have been steadily stripped of everything that organized men and women who rose up in defiance and were purged, demonized, and killed by the capitalist elites achieved with the New Deal. The victories of African Americans who paid with their bodies and blood in making possible the Great Society and ending legal segregation also have been reversed. The corporate state makes no pretense of addressing social inequality or white supremacy. It practices only the politics of vengeance. It uses coercion, fear, violence, police terror, and mass incarceration as forms of social control, while it cannibalizes the nation and the globe for profits. Our cells of resistance have to be rebuilt from scratch.
Thanks very much for your time, Chris Hedges.
Thanks, David.
You were just listening to Chris Hedges on Rise Up and Resist. I talked with him in Boulder, Colorado. Chris Hedges is an award-winning journalist who writes a weekly column for TruthDig.com. He's the author of many books, including America, The Farewell Tour. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization, Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as David Stannard, Francis Fox Piven, Ralph Nader, Abby Martin, Ramsey Baroud, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and Noam Chomsky. We also have a dozen Chris Hedges programs. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. Special thanks to KGNU. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening.